Thomas Jefferson. We'll pick up where we left off last week, wrap up the background on Jefferson, and then continue on. Just before I proceed, was there anyone that missed the handouts from last week?
Thanks, sir.
So briefly, just to pick up where we left off last time, we had completed the background on Adams, and we're working through our way through Jefferson, and we had come to a point where he had become an up-and-coming lawyer, had begun what would become a lifelong work and passion, building his home, his estate really, on Monticello. And his beginning into the realm of politics with his election to the House of Burgesses in 1768. The other element of his life comes to his marriage to a Martha Wales Skelton, a widow, on New Year's Day of 1772. And similar to Adams, he also marries. He's actually quite old for his age. He's 28. Adams married at 29. With the dowry, Jefferson more than doubled his holdings in land and slaves. And although none of the correspondence survives between Jefferson and Martha, all indications are that their marriage was a happy one. And although Martha, unfortunately, doesn't survive nearly as long as Abigail, her presence in Jefferson's life was likely quite influential, evidenced by Jefferson's devastation following her death in 1782. Their family life was difficult, to say the least. They have together six children, only two of whom actually lived to adulthood. And in fact, even before their marriage, Martha's four-year-old son from her previous marriage dies the summer before. But their two daughters that live to adulthood, Martha, or Patsy Jefferson, born in 1772 in September, and Maria, or Polly Jefferson, is born in August of 1778. So that sort of rounds out their early life in backgrounds. So to sort of summarize a little bit, certainly not to list out everything, but I think it's important or worth taking note of some of the intriguing parallels between Jefferson and Adams in their early life, because I think it helps sort of formulate or understand why it is that they were, despite coming from such different backgrounds, were able to form a quick friendship in June of 1775. One thing is that they both have a deep respect and admiration for their fathers. Both lose them fairly young, Jefferson a little younger than Adams was, but that's one thing they certainly have in common. The other thing is they both sort of come to age and complete their, even though they have sort of an early aversion to schooling, they both, as a result of some inspiring teachers, both learn to love to study and really complete their transformation in college, and they both discover their love of reading, etc. Both choose law as a profession, and which obviously prepares them well for the constitutional arguments that envelop the colonies, as we'll get into today. The other thing I think to point out, quite important, is they both take their time in finding a wife, and they also choose quite wisely. And I think that's something that they both share, they both have in common, and are there, with that, I'll close with the sort of the background. Are there any questions or comments up to this point?
So, Ryan, are you going to expand upon that more, or are you going to move into something else? Because if you're going to move into something else, I'm curious as in a little more detail, specifically how they took their time. What is it specifically that they that they sought in keeping away?
Well, one thing that sort of just in general, their age. Jefferson was 28, Adams was 29. That's actually quite old for their time to actually get married. In terms of what they were looking for, I don't have a specific list or details in that. I shared a little bit from Adams' own diary. He's kind of writing at the time, just prior to and while he's courting Abigail, that ballast is what I need. I tide her with every breeze. So he was sort of looking for someone that was going to sort of give him a foundation, because he knew he had the tendency to sort of move from one thing to another, and certainly that's what he gets with Abigail. She has a way of being able to sort of refocus and redirect him on in certain areas, as we'll see throughout their lives. As far as Jefferson, I'm a little less familiar, and part of that is because Jefferson is a little bit more difficult to peg down that way. He actually destroys most of their private correspondence he has with Martha during their life. Yeah, and most of his personal letters, in fact, he destroys. He sort of wants to hide or keep that sort of private, so it seems. So it's a little bit less known exactly what their courtship was like, and even their specifically what their relationship was like. Although all indications are that it was a happy one. Certainly, just in terms of the you know, the places where they're from, certainly what was important for Jefferson was the dowry. And
is that specific that, just to Jefferson?
No, that was, you know, any time, yeah.
Then, right?
That's exactly right. So that wouldn't be specific to Jefferson, but that certainly would have been a pro in the column for Martha. Certainly not the only Virginian to marry well. Certainly George Washington, also in a similar situation, more than doubled his holdings in his marriage. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Egger.
I just remember that from that book read years ago, The Millionaire Next Door.
Yes.
And it brought out with data that one of the most common traits of successful people was marrying. The marriage was very significant as far as whether or not they would later on be successful. And then I heard or read somewhere recently that many people today look at marriage as a long date, it should be a big long date. They find that disappointing. It would be better if they looked at it as a business partnership. It seems to resonate with Adams and Jefferson.
Yeah. And what's most interesting, I think, in particular with Adams, and it appears to be so with Jefferson, they sort of had both. It wasn't just the business transaction or business relationship. So with that, we'll move on. Fast forward a little bit. When Jefferson and Adams meet in sort of that time period, and how their relationship started, how how it came to be. But in order to understand why that relationship was established, you really need to understand the amount of effort that went into and that was required to secure independence in July of 1776. During that time, despite really essentially over a year of open conflict and war, there was still significant resistance to officially severing ties with Great Britain. And this therefore required a lot of political maneuvering, a lot of debate on the floor of Congress. And through this, there's sort of a political alliance or partnership that develops between the delegates in Virginia and Massachusetts to sort of push the agenda of the Congress towards independence. And this results, of course, while this is going on, there's also the day-to-day business of administering the Congress as the impromptu national government in a time of essentially war. As a result of that, there's a division of labor in which Jefferson and Adams are able to contribute to the cause in ways that are really best suited for them. And Adams, that would be through debate. With Jefferson, it would be through his pen. But before we get into even the details there, sort of it's worth reviewing the events that led up to that summer at the Second Continental Congress. It's somewhat familiar history, but I think it's worth reviewing at least a little bit, not in any lengthy detail. But can anyone think of any of the parliamentary acts or proclamations by George III that sort of initiated and led to some of the hostilities that eventually led to the War for Independence?
Stamp Act.
Stamp Act, that's a huge one, 1765.
Quartering
Act. I don't have a specific date on that, but that was a big one. Anything else?
A series of called the Intolerable Acts.
Yes, that was together also the Coercive Acts, you'll hear it called, I believe. Essentially, beginning all the way from 1763, at the end of the French and Indian War, where Britain has amassed, as a result of that victory, quite a large new territory. And George III, sort of in an effort to, ironically, be responsibly controlling of that new territory, begins even as early as 1763. He makes a proclamation that there should be no westward expansion beyond the Allegheny Mountains, which proclamation is one thing, actually enforcing it was another, but it's sort of a way of trying to control, keep the population in an area that he could control, and various acts of Parliament to raise revenue such that the governing of the colonies would be possible from the Crown's perspective. And, of course, through all these, the key issue, as we're fairly familiar with at this point, was the right of Parliament to legislate taxes for the colonies, or over the colonies, at least initially. That's what the arguments were. Eventually, as these things progress, as the arguments progress, the argument isn't just on Parliament's authority to levy taxes, but also just legislate in general for the colonies. And so within that framework, Adams and Jefferson, as lawyers, are certainly participate in these constitutional arguments. Not only obviously in debate and discussions, but through various writings and pamphlets. For Adams, as early as 1765, he writes a dissertation on canon and feudal law, where he's asserting that American freedoms are not just ideals, but they're actually rights that are established by British law. And you'll see with, or it's very apparent with Adams, he's actually quite a proponent of British law, He's not necessarily an enemy of British law per se, and you can see that right in that in his first dissertation, that these rights that we're talking about, they're not sort of these nebulous or ideals, that they're actually built right into the British law. And later on, in a series of essays that get termed as Novanglus, he begins on the road of rejecting Parliament's authority over all domestic policy for the colonies, that they've sort of been legislating for themselves all along, and that the Parliament does not hold any legislative power over them. On Jefferson's side, his big writing that gets him sort of on the center stage in the public's eye is this, written in 1774, and it's initially meant as a set of instructions for the Virginia delegates to the First Continental Congress, which meets in 1774, that Jefferson is not included with. He sort of takes it upon himself to write this set of instructions that the delegates don't really pay any attention to. But following that, it actually gets published as a pamphlet, and it gets termed A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And again, it's this idea that British Parliament doesn't have any right to exercise authority over the colonies. Interesting development with this particular document, unlike the others at this time, is it starts to contain indictments against George III, which is an important development, and it's actually sort of a precursor to the Declaration in many ways, and the indictments of George III in that. At this point, the king was largely held still in the public's opinion as sort of an innocent bystander to Parliament and the various lords administering these, conspiring to legislate and subjugate the Americans. But it certainly does bring him quite a bit of reputation. According to Adams, this is where he gets his reputation as a masterly pen. And he brings that with him when he joins the Second Continental Congress. The tensions escalate as the British start enforcing these acts by military force. And of course, this is all centered essentially mainly in Boston. Beginning in 1768, they begin quartering troops in Boston to keep the peace. Eventually leads to what eventually becomes known as the Boston Massacre, where essentially a mob attacks a sentry, and troops come up and in support of the sentry, shots are fired, and depending on which account you read, either five or six members of the mob are killed. Of course, the event is highly politicized through Paul Revere and as well as Sam Adams. Interestingly, John Adams steps in and defends both the captain and the soldiers who are put on trial for the murder of those individuals, and successfully defends them. It's an important thing to recognize in Adams' life, because it's speaks to his a big part of his character and what he views as being virtuous, is that the public opinion in and around Boston at that time was that these both the captain and these soldiers were murderers and deserved to be punished as such. Adams did not feel that was the case, and felt that the facts of the case argued differently. And so, rather than bowing down to public opinion, and sort of would have been the popular thing to do, he rises above it in his mind to do what's right. And that's something he is very important with important to him, and he brings with him throughout his political career, sometimes to his detriment. All familiar with the Boston Tea Party in December of 1773. In reaction to this, the Coercive Acts come in 1774, which essentially closes the port of Boston to trade until remedies are made for the tea that is lost in the Boston Tea Party. There's martial law declared. So this brings about the First Continental Congress in the summer and into fall of 1774. While important for kind of that initial fostering of, you know, intercolonial support and sort of a common cause, it doesn't or accomplishes very little. But Lexington and Concord sort of changes the game. April 19th, 1775, the shot heard around the world. Now there's open conflict. Something that there had not been up to that point. And so when the Second Continental Congress convenes that summer of 1775, Adams moves to appoint George Washington, a Virginian, which Adams thought was important for the appointment to command what would become the Continental Army. So that motion is carried. In July of 1775, there's two sorts of things that occur that are important. One is the sort of moderates within the Congress that are still really holding out for any chance at peace, work together in Congress to generate the Olive Branch Petition, which is essentially a last effort to appeal directly to George III for, you know, a redress of grievances. Adams and the other independence-minded folks feel it's too late in the game for that, but nevertheless, it carries. And on the other side of it, in addition to that, they sort of need to deal with the fact that, they're interested in peace, but the fact is they're in an open conflict with Great Britain at this time. And Jefferson has a hand in drafting a declaration of the causes and necessities for taking up arms, which, among other things, the main storyline within that is that the Americans are cast as innocent victims and are sort of really not being overtly looking to fight a war for independence, but more that it's being forced out of them, that they're having to defend themselves through the actions of the British government. Following that, there's, as we move into 1776, there are several events that sort of work together, I think, to bring about and pave the way for the Declaration. Can anyone have any guesses or thoughts on what those things may have been in early in the spring and in summer of 1776? One is a pamphlet written by Thomas Paine.
Common Sense.
Yes. He writes that in January 1776. And this has a profound impact, not so much on Congress directly, but more so in the minds of the public in general. And part of the reason for that is the tracts up to that point had been largely constitutional in nature, constitutional arguments, and not that the American public were dull to those ideas, but common sense was written in such a way that sort of the common man would sort of made the idea of independence inevitable and the right thing to do. So it sort of pushed public opinion in support of independence more so than Congress. But that was certainly an important element towards getting the delegates within the Congress to ultimately vote for independence. Does anyone know what happened to the Olive Branch petition? It does get shipped out in 1775, summer 1775. Anyone know what happens to that petition? Never. He received it. He never read it. And so in February of 1776, they get word back essentially that the Parliament and the King have basically branded them as traitors. Anyone who's not going to subject themselves would be considered traitors. And I believe at this point they're beginning to hear that the British government is actually starting to hire mercenaries, and there's a fleet coming, bringing those mercenaries. So sort of the idea of a peace is starting to crumble. Although folks like Adams thought it was already apparent back in 1775, even for the moderates, it's beginning to really push them in an uneasy spot, that they're really having to recognize that there's really no hope of any reconciliation here. Although there are some that still cling to that idea up until the last. Another thing that sort of a lot of people may not point to, but I would like to point to, is the American victory in Boston, military victory. It's not really a battle per se, and so I think it gets sort of skirted around. But March 17th, 1776, the British fleet is forced to leave the port of Boston. So it's sort of the first real victory, significant victory, for the American troops. And it's brought about because they effectively maneuver some new cannon from Fort Ticonderoga into place that really put the city of Boston and the British troops there in an untenable situation. It's March 17th, that 1776. So that brings with it, I think, sort of the mentality that it is possible for the American military might to prevail against, you know, what was held to be at that time the biggest and best military power in the world. Even though, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the war, it didn't really mean anything. I mean, the British just sort of moved off and were just getting ready to make their assault on New York, which they were ultimately very successful in. But I think at the time, I think would be significant in just in terms of public opinion, showing that it was a possibility that the Americans could sort of carry the field. The other thing that's probably most important, and certainly Adams would argue this to be the case, is that the colonies began to establish independent state governments. Even before the passage of the Declaration, or the drafting of the Declaration. And this was in May 15th of 76, and it's a resolution that's initially brought forth by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, but really carried to completion by Adams, and it's largely influenced. He has a document at this time that he publishes called Thoughts on Government, Among other things, he really proposes at that point many elements that we see in our governments today, the bicameral legislature and the independent judiciary. And as such, it becomes a model for most of the new state constitutions that get written as a result of this passing resolution, which makes Adams actually quite busy as an advisor during this time. But this is, and Adams will even go so far as to argue that's really when independence was became a reality, was that date. Certainly up for debate. But as his argument would go, that once the colonies made the decision to create their own independent governments, that they would not then relinquish that. Argument would go. But I think it's important on an even more fundamental level in paving the way for the Declaration, and ultimately I think plays a major role into why the Declaration and the War for Independence was ultimately successful, is that it was establishing governments, putting in place governments prior to throwing off the old. The struggle for independence wasn't just a throwing off of British authority. It was sort of reestablishing, I'll even say, in a new way, their own colonial and what would then become state governments, which prevented, I think, in a large degree, what ultimately happened in the French Revolution in terms of anarchy and mob rule. There was already governments in place when the sever was made with the British government. So those are some of the things that I think paved the way. Ultimately, it was, again, similar to the state government resolution. Richard Henry Lee, on June 7th, makes the resolution that the colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent. Adams quickly seconds the motion. The vote is delayed as the delegates need to receive new instructions on how to vote from their from the various colonial assemblies. And so in the meantime, a committee is formed to draft a declaration in the event that the resolution passes in the affirmative. And there's five members of the committee, Adams and Jefferson obviously being two of them. Does anyone know the other three? One of them everyone should know.
Wasn't Franklin on that committee?
Franklin, yep. Anyone else on the, I didn't. Robert Livingston and Roger Sherman. Unknown to me exactly what their contributions were specifically, but in any event, they were a part of the committee. So as far as Adams gets appointed as the chair of the committee, sort of in recognition of his leadership on the floor and pushing for independence, and but the sort of the first person that you would think of, the one with the best ability to write, would have been Franklin. And it was well recognized by all the other members of Congress, and so he would have been the first choice, but he rejects it, and part of that is because he makes it a point of not allowing his writings to be edited by a committee. So it sort of falls on either Adams or Jefferson, and there's accounts differ between Adams and Jefferson, but suffice it to say, Jefferson is ultimately selected, and part of that is because of his recognition that he is a skilled writer. It's interesting at this point that sort of no one really sees or foresees how important the authorship of the Declaration ultimately becomes in the minds of current-day historians and Americans. Because if they had, I don't think too many of them would have shied away like they had. So Jefferson takes it upon himself to write the Declaration, and it really only takes him a few days. Interestingly, he writes it on a writing desk of his own invention, some sort of a implementation, which is again shows his multitude of abilities. But he writes it. They comes back to the committee. They make a few alterations, but largely keep it intact. So the Declaration is ready to go, but of course that it's meaningless unless the resolution passes. So the debate on the floor actually occurs on July 1st. John Dickinson, again, the Pennsylvania farmer, he's the head of the moderates at this point, argues against separation, and Adams argues for. Fortunately, there's no transcription, there's no notes kept of these debates, but there's enough evidence of people writing after that this is considered Adams' sort of finest hour in terms of debating and eloquence, and really sort of is looked at as really sort of winning the argument at that point. So the vote carries 4th, but July 2nd, which Adams actually writes to Abigail, sort of foreseeing the celebrations that we now have on July 4th as occurring on July 2nd in future generations. But it's interesting that as of July 1st, there were actually, they sort of had a preliminary vote on July 1st, and there were still 4 colonies that were holding back, that were not voting for independence. And sort of there's some backroom dealings, different things that go on. The morning of July 2nd, when the votes are actually counted and cast officially, as far as the 4 that are that had been holding back, Philadelphia, the 2 delegates that were against it, remain absent, so Philadelphia becomes a yes vote. Delaware, there's a Caesar Rodney who shows up sort of at the last minute to get a majority for yes for Delaware. South Carolina changes its vote to a yes, and New York continues to abstain. So it just goes to show sort of how fluid and how you know, we sort of look back on it as matter of fact, inevitable, that these things came about. But at the time, obviously, just like any history, that it was really a close and undecided until the very last. It's at that point, after the resolution is adopted, that the Declaration is presented and the language of it is debated for a couple of days. Jefferson balks at the idea of them making corrections, which they ultimately do to some extent. And then the date July 4th, does anyone know what date that really signifies and why it has become what we call Independence Day?
the last signature was
the
one?
No, and
was that July 6th?
No, that there were some of the signatures that weren't put on there until like August, actually.
Is that the day they sent it to England?
They sent it to for printing on July 4th. So Just a bit of trivia there. So in summary, in this sort of long convoluted story I just went through, we see two men that have the different but particular giftings that work together to bring about or a common purpose, and they are ultimately successful in that. And I just would point to the idea that isn't that what we're called to do in the church? You know, we're all given different giftings in different areas, and yet we're called to come together in common purpose for the kingdom. And I personally find the story of Adams and Jefferson, particularly in this time in the Second Continental Congress, to be sort of a good example of that in action in history. But with that, that's all I have for today. If anyone else has any comments or questions. Yes.
As you were talking about the Committee for the Declaration of Independence, I was reading a little bit about the Declaration of Independence over the July 4th weekend. One of the things that was mentioned was that one of the reasons that Thomas Jefferson was picked was that John Adams was from Massachusetts, and politically they were afraid that the colonies that were kind of on the fence, if they saw that John Adams wrote it because he was from Massachusetts, they would immediately say no. And I thought, you know, John Adams is, he knew that the cause was greater than his ego. He seemed like very humble just to, I mean, I think that he, even if he had a hand in the writing, he would let Thomas Jefferson have his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thought that the cause was greater.
Well, part of it too, yeah, I would say that, but I think part of it was he didn't recognize how important that document was going to become. But that is something that certainly did influence Adams, and that was certainly conscious on his mind when he put forward to have George Washington command the troops. It was important to him that it was a Virginian. He certainly recognized the importance of that politically in establishing union between the different colonies. Mr. Edgar.
I've always been curious about why the British military submitted to the civilian court to adjudicate the Boston Massacre. Because, you know, we hear today, like whenever there's a case of a U.S. military person having a criminal accusation against a civilian of some location, it always gets kicked to the U.S. court, and the civilian population is either happier or displeased with the result of that court. But here we have the soldiers of the British military under command of the British military submitting themselves to a colonial civilian court that didn't even have a legitimate state government operating then, or if they did, it was still under
British authority at that point, because this is still early. This is 1770, so it's really before.
It was
significant.
A British court in reality, wasn't it?
Yes.
But it was a civilian
yes.
court, though.
Yes.
That's
as far as I know.
To me, it wasn't like a military tribunal.
That's true. Would be interesting to know if the verdicts had gone the other way,
yeah.
Because Adams was successful in defending. There were some minor, I think one or two of the soldiers had to be branded on their hand. But other than that, they were vindicated. I wonder if it would have been, if the British military would have intervened had it gone the other way. I don't know specifically, but
they
certainly
might
is interesting.
They lived that long, though. those soldiers involved.
Right.
They may have known that they were going to hang, whether they submitted to the court or not at that point.
Maybe. But it became a, you know, initially it was a public outcry, but then of course, you know, the political machinery turned it into, you know, a real example of, see, when we're allowed to exercise law and govern ourselves, we are able to execute judgment,
well,
you know,
that
justice.
Happened quite a while before the writing of the Declaration, actually,
mm-hmm.
which kind of furthers my theory on it, is had Britain treated the American colonists like British citizens and white and human, and just talked to them, you know, instituted a conversation, the whole thing wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. We'd still be talking with a stuffy British accent.
I think you're absolutely right, and Franklin, I think, would have been that would have most closely resembled his position.
Well, I think most of them at that point, except for a few firebrands, had mm-hmm. a sufficient disdain of war then and knew what its result would be as far as bodies, and willing to have taken up a reasonable British subjecthood as mm-hmm. opposed to having to have most of their people die mm-hmm. early.
Any other closing comments? We're a little bit over. Mr. Egger, would you mind closing us in prayer?